This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, we are going to talk about some controversies in hip-hop recently that raise questions about just what crosses the line now between what's acceptable and what isn't, and who decides that. That's coming up later in the program. But first, we are going to head to Cleveland, where details are still coming out about what exactly happened to three young women there. As you've no doubt heard by now, a woman who had been reported missing a decade ago escaped from a Cleveland house. That led to the discovery of two more women who had been missing for a very long time. Three men have now been arrested in connection with that disappearance. But for a lot of people, this story is bringing up more questions than answers. Rachel Sell is a reporter with the Cleveland Plain Dealer. She's been following this story. And Rachel, we know you're very busy, so thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
So after the initial euphoria of finding these young women alive, what I think a lot of people want to know now is, how could something like this happen? Is there something special about this area that would allow somebody to hide three women, allegedly, for a decade and have no one discover it?
You know, I think the neighbors are asking themselves those same questions now. You know, what didn't we see? What should we have seen? But what we're really hearing, too, from investigators and police sources is that that Ariel Castro went to great lengths, you know, to keep these women hidden away. And so I think that those are details that are going to take a little while to come out as these women are able to tell their stories. And actually, kind of breaking news right now, Amanda Berry, one of the women, is about to return home, and she's actually expected to make a statement to the many people who are gathered at her house. I'm doubting she'll go into a lot of detail, but I think that, you know, in time we will hear from these women what happened, and some of it will make a little bit more sense. But one of the things that we've also encountered is, you know, for many years people have thought that these were maybe separate kidnappings. These women were snatched kind of off the street, and the more reporting we do, the more we find out that there were connections between Ariel Castro and between his daughters. You know, we've learned that the one daughter knew Gina DeJesus, and was friends with her, was actually the last person to see her. And then we also know that the other daughter, we're told, knew Amanda Berry and lived in a home very close to Amanda Berry's. So he had an opportunity to know these girls when they were taken, now they're women, and maybe either gain their trust or be a person that at least they weren't afraid of getting in a car with.
For many people in Cleveland, I think this, or maybe really around the country, this may have brought back memories of the Anthony Soul case, which you also covered. And back in 2009, the bodies of 11 women were found on this man's property in Cleveland. There were reports that the police missed a lot of chances to catch him early. So I wanted to ask you, first of all, as a person who's covered both of these cases, do you see any parallels there? And are there any credible reports that there were chances to perhaps get access to this situation earlier that were missed?
Sure. While they both involve missing persons cases, I do believe that this case is quite different. The Amanda Berry and the Gina DeJesus cases, at least, not maybe the Michelle Knight case, got a lot of attention from local media, people that followed the case for years, but also from police and the FBI. I know a number of officers who literally have been working this case for 10 years, served numerous search warrants on houses of people that may have had information. They dug up a one lot. They you know, took one guy's house apart, pretty much dismantled it based on tips. So they really were trying hard to make an investigation in this case, you know, come to a conclusion. They really stayed close with the families. The Michelle Knight story is a little bit different. She was an adult when she went missing, and cases like that generally don't get as much attention. Also, information from her family that went to the police, you know, led them to think she may have left on her own. But I do think that looking at these cases always makes us go back and reflect and say, what can be done better? I mean, just like the Sowell case did. And I'm sure that in many ways, though this case, you know, is coming to a resolution that has a much, much better ending than that, the police will still go back and look, and the FBI is very good at going back and looking, you know, was there something that we should have done that we didn't or could have done better?
Is it true, though, that after the Sowell case that the Cleveland police actually did go back and do a review of the way they handled missing persons cases?
Sure. There was a large, large review. The mayor appointed some independent people to a commission to really review all the things, and they made many recommendations about centralizing the process, about giving more information to family members about what they can do and what is being done. And actually, Gina DeJesus' parents were a part of that process. I mean, they came to meetings, they talked talked to police. They gave input on the brochures that, that parents could get to kind of let them know what was going on in their case. And they've stayed involved in the missing persons issues, and they've also stayed involved in human trafficking issues. You know, as recent as last month, they were going and flyering around the issue of human trafficking, really believing that that probably had some connection to their daughter's case.
We're speaking with the Plain Dealers, Rachel DeSalle, about those apparent kidnappings in Cleveland. As you probably know by now, three women have recently escaped from a situation in which they seem to have been held against their will for almost a decade, many of them living very close together. You know, there have been some TV reports of people saying that they saw suspicious activity at the house where these women were held over the year and that they called police, but that there was not a response or that the police never entered the house. Have any of those reports been substantiated?
You know, police talked about two different reports in which they dealt with Ariel Castro over the years. One was involved involving a missing a child that was on his school bus that didn't get delivered to school and then he took back home. They did go there and knock on the door. He wasn't there, but they later interviewed him somewhere else and came to the conclusion that it was a mistake rather than something that he did purposefully. And he was written up for it at work and got in some trouble. And then there was one other time that he called police to report a fight in front of the house. Now, other neighbors have told other media outlets and have told some of our reporters that there was calls about suspicious behavior, you know, women in the backyard that didn't have clothes on and other things like that. Police have said that they have absolutely no record of those calls ever coming in. Not that reports weren't made, but they don't even have records of the calls coming in. So, you know, it's kind of hard to tell right now, but I'm thinking that some of those people, are they remembering things later? I don't know. Police say there's just no truth to it.
One of the things that is noteworthy is the fact that you have been covering these cases for so long. I mean, living in a big sort of urban area, you know, myself, there are still young people here who've been missing, who have never been recovered. And I just don't wonder that the attention that your paper has given to this case, you know, all these years, the fact that the police seem to have stayed actually involved in trying to pursue leads in this case. I'm interested in that aspect of it. Is it in part, we think, because the family members were aggressive about insisting that that happen?
These family members were tireless. And, you know, before she died a number of years ago, Amanda Berry's mother, I mean, she would call and talk to just any reporter in town, you know, newspaper, TV, anybody who would give any attention to the case, just repeating the details, trying to spark some kind of memory, a witness, anything. And the same with Gina DeJesus' parents. They not only would have a vigil, you know, once a year, but they would put flyers everywhere. I live pretty near to where actually this house on Seymour Avenue is, probably less than a minute. And the neighborhoods where the girls disappeared in this house are pretty close together, within a couple miles. You could not walk into a corner store or a diner without seeing their pictures. Mm-hmm. Fresh posters always with information, you know, age enhancements. So I think that their dedication definitely brought a lot of attention to it.
And before we let you go, in the time that we have left, I wanted to ask, what's your sense of how the community is responding to this? I mean, I've heard conflicting things. On the one hand, I think there are some people who feel very proud. They feel very proud of the fact that, you know, at a moment of need, a person, a neighbor stepped up and aggressively responded and did the right thing. But I've also seen that there are two high profile incidents of women going missing and for a very long time. And there has to be a sense. In fact, I heard Mr. Ramsey, Charles Ramsey, who is the neighbor who came to the aid of Amanda Berry and kind of led to her rescuing the other two women, saying that he feels a sense of guilt and shame that he didn't know about this sooner because he wished that he could have helped sooner. And I just wonder, what's your sense of how, you know, I know it's a difficult question, but more broadly, how do you feel the community is reacting to all this?
No, I think, as I said earlier, they're still in a sense of shock, and everybody wants to know if there was something that could have, you know, been done. There's always soul searching after any incident like this. But I think two people are really rejoicing in the fact that they are actually alive. You know, they do appear to be at least physically okay, though, you know, many have cautioned that mentally this is going to be a really long journey for them. And I think the community is starting to shift focus to the ways in which they can support them and make sure that they have what they need because they have been gone so long and you know, they want them to know that people have missed them and that people looked for them and are willing to take care of them for as long as they need so that they can heal.
What more broadly do you think, though, we've talked about kind of an after-action review after that 2009 incident involving Anthony Sowell. Do you feel, or are any community leaders there feeling, from whatever sphere, feeling that there's some kind of community-wide discussion that might need to take place about the way we are accountable to each other as neighbors?
Sure. I think that conversation may be beginning, but I think that there's still so much information to come out. It's hard to have, a thorough conversation, a robust conversation, until you really know the extent of what these guys apparently did, what the details are, how it happened, and then what we know or could have known. I mean, you just have to have a little bit more information, I think, before you can have a proper discussion on it.
And finally, as a journalist yourself, what are you interested in right now? If I don't, if you don't mind my asking, it's interesting. You've covered, unfortunately, you've found it your responsibility to cover a number of cases involving missing people, young people, and I wonder what questions do you have?
I think that like all of us, I have many questions on, how these women survived. I mean, it just had to be an incredible situation from what we've heard, that they were, being restrained, that, how were they, being fed? How did they have to interact with each other? I mean, I think they probably have some incredible stories of survival. But while I think those stories are incredible, I'm also the type of reporter that thinks we need to give them the space and allow them to tell the stories in their own way and in their own times.
Well, we'll be interested to hear as you report this story in the future. We'll be interested to hear more of your work, and thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Rachel DeCell is a reporter for The Plain Dealer in Cleveland. She joined us by phone from the newsroom. Rachel, thanks again.
Thanks.
Coming up, music fans go to concerts to have a little fun and maybe escape reality for a few hours. But one fan reportedly took it too far with rapper Danny Brown at a recent show that has opened up some real and complicated talk about hip-hop, sexuality, and mainstream culture. We go to a roundtable of music and culture commentators for a fresh cut. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up as we approach Mother's Day this Sunday, we're checking out a new book. It's called What My Mother Gave Me. It's about the special gifts mothers give their daughters. That's just ahead. But first, we want to talk about something that if you follow hip-hop, you might have heard about, and if you haven't, you probably will. And this is probably a good time to tell you that this discussion will involve issues of sexuality and might not be appropriate for all listeners. At a concert in Minneapolis recently, a woman from the audience allegedly performed a sex act on rapper Danny Brown during the show. There's been a storm of reaction to this on social media, and we thought this whole issue and the response to it raised some interesting and important questions about sexuality in popular media, and especially hip-hop. So to talk about this, we've called Mark Anthony Neal. He is a professor of Black popular culture at Duke University. Danielle Belton is with us. She's editor of Clutch Magazine Online. She's also the creator of the Black Snob blog. Malik Washington is the deputy director of the William Killebrew Foundation. Through that work, he mentors young men, and one of the areas in which he counsels them is issues like this, sexuality. Also joining us is Jessica Hopper. She's a music critic and columnist for The Village Voice. We're calling this The Salon, combining our barbershop and beauty shop roundtables, as actually one listener urged us to do. So thank you all so much for joining us for this.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to
Thank
be
you.
Here, Michelle.
You know, I have so many questions about this, but I want to start by noting one thing. Brown himself did not write about this or talk about this. This issue surfaced because rapper Kitty Pryde, who was his opening act, wrote passionately in her blog that this was plainly a sexual assault, that people have been condemning Brown for this, calling him a misogynist, and she thinks that that's crazy. And people have also condemned her for, and again, this is where language advisory comes into play, for slut-shaming, for criticizing this behavior. So I want to note that this is, in fact, how we know about this. I'm just going to go around and ask each of you, what are your first thoughts about this? Mark? Anthony Neal, Professor Neal, you want to start?
It was a surprising story to me. I mean, this is a narrative that we normally don't hear about male sexual assault, sexual assault against men. It's a narrative we don't hear, and clearly not something that we hear in the world of hip-hop. So the idea that there was some sort of public incident along these lines, really challenges, I think, our sensibilities and interpretations of what masculinity looks like in the context of hip-hop, or can look like in the context of hip-hop.
Danielle, what do you think?
I was disturbed by it. Like, I wasn't necessarily surprised, because often in these concerts, you have overzealous fans who will do crazy things. So I wasn't necessarily surprised by it, especially considering, you know, his lyrics tend to be very sexual. But at the same time, I was, like, appalled and disgusted, because there is no such thing as consent. I don't know how you're able to consent to anything when you're in the middle of rapping.
Okay, so you were appalled. But what were you most appalled and disgusted by? The fact that somebody would do this? The fact that somebody would do this publicly? The reaction to it? What was it that appalled and disgusted you?
The fact that a woman would get up on the stage and do this to someone while they were performing. Because it's like, mm-hmm. how many different reactions can you have this year in the middle of a performance? It's a violation. That was probably the most appalling thing for me right there to begin with, because I immediately put myself in his shoes. Like, what do you do? Do you stop what you're doing right now? Do you have an altercation on the stage? And then the fact that people do view things differently when it's a male. You know, there was a limited amount of things that he could do without people just blaming him for it, even though he did not ask for it or consent to it.
And I'm going to jump in here to say that we aren't really sure exactly what happened. We know the facts as they've been described by his colleague, Kitty Pryde. But, you know, I wasn't there. None of us was there. And there are those who are alleging on Twitter, of course, on social media, that maybe this whole thing was planned. I certainly don't know. I just feel like I need to, for the sake of fairness, to point that out. Malik, what are your thoughts about this?
It was shocking. I mean, not only because you're doing this while somebody's performing, but you have a large audience of thousands of people. I'm just wondering what's going on while this is happening. Danny Brown did mention it. Somebody asked about him on Twitter. Kendrick Lamar tweeted about it on Twitter, and he responded. He said he didn't miss a bar. Those were his words while it happened. It was one of the few times, I think, that life kind of met art. I mean, these are the things that a lot of rappers talk about, specifically Danny Brown. He's very explicit, even by hip-hop standards. So it was a moment where it was like, wow, this actually happened. Like, this is something that I just feel like I should be hearing in a hip-hop song.
Jessica, what about you? And you cover music for a number of publications. You weren't at this particular concert, but you certainly cover a lot of them. Have you ever heard of anything like this, and what do you make of it?
I think the last time, you know, this historically has happened was at a Doors show in Miami in 1969. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of precedence for sexual acts happening on stage at shows. The thing is that this happened at a place called the Triple Rock Social Club, which is a small club in Minneapolis. It's known to be very artist-friendly, and it's really unfortunate that someone took advantage of really their proximity to Danny Brown. I mean, the stage there is maybe 2 feet tall. There's no barrier. There's no security. This wasn't a Bieber sort of situation of getting, you know, sort of tackled by a fan and there's this wall of security, you know, that's going to take care of it. And someone really, while Danny was obviously interacting with the crowd, someone took it upon themselves to sort of breach that unspoken barrier. And I think that's unfortunate for everybody.
Well, why do you say that?
As people are saying, it is a violation. I mean, you talk about this wouldn't happen at a show at an arena because you're so far away. And so here's a chance to see Danny Brown, someone who's an exciting person within music, within hip hop, and someone literally is sort of transgressing this unspoken barrier.
Does it change anybody's feelings about this that Danny Brown himself is not the person who seems to have complained about this? I mean, Kitty Pryde in her blog was very clear that she felt this was wrong. She was disgusted by it. She felt very clearly that this was an assault. She said if the tables had been turned, if a man in the audience had gotten up on stage and touched a woman performer mm-hmm. in this mm-hmm. way, it would have clearly been seen as an assault, and she doesn't understand why it isn't being seen in that way. Does it change anybody's feelings about this? That Brown himself doesn't seem to have complained.
I'm sure Mr. Brown himself is a little conflicted about this, particularly the way that, you know, masculinity is trafficked in the context of hip-hop. There are very few narratives in our culture in which men complain about sex or having sex. I mean, that's just not a narrative that most mainstream people think about in relationship to masculinity. You know, so how on the one hand does he acknowledge the fact that he's vulnerable up on stage? I mean, that's part of what Jessica is saying. He's vulnerable up on stage. There was a violation, but how does he express it in the way that doesn't go against the way that masculinity is practiced within the context or performed in the context of hip-hop?
Malik, what about you? I know. Do you mind if I mention that when we first called you about this, you said that when you first heard about this, the thought of sexual assault didn't even cross your mind? Have you changed your mind?
Yeah, I did change my mind. I think Kitty Pryde's column or blog, whatever you want to call it, was very thoughtful. It was very intelligent and well-spoken, and it made me think. I mean, I think there was a line, and we have to separate consent and enjoyment. I think some people conflate the two. Just because somebody enjoyed this act doesn't mean that they actually consented to it. And then when we know that consent is the piece that how we define sexual assault. And if he did not consent, then that is an assault. What Professor Neal said is absolutely correct. He's probably very conflicted. And I think that it would take somebody else, specifically a woman, to be vocal about this, to actually bring it to people's attention and make them see it in a different light.
You know what's interesting is that this is also coming after Reebok. And Jessica, I'm going to ask you this. Reebok moved to end its relationship with Rick Ross. He had an endorsement deal with Reebok. First of all, there were lyrics that seemed to endorse date rape. And then Lil Wayne was recently dropped by Mountain Dew over lyrics about, you know, Emmett Till. And so I think a lot of people are kind of saying, well, right, where is the line? And is the line created by the audience when they pick their heads up and say, this is okay versus not okay? Because I still have to point out that there are a lot of people on social media who are on both sides of this. Some people think that Kitty Pryde was... she's wrong to complain about it. Some people are calling Brown a misogynist for reasons that I still aren't quite clear. So, Jessica, why don't you weigh in here?
Well, I think the issue with Lil Wayne and also Rick Ross, those are issues that are more about that's an issue of artistic expression. I mean, with Danny Brown here, he wasn't it doesn't behoove him in this situation to be provocative in the same way that having provocative lyrics for Rick Ross or Lil Wayne is part of their image. This seems to be something that's much more spontaneous. It wasn't something that was issued to the public. It was issued, I mean, it occurred at a club that's a few hundred capacity. And so it wasn't meant for a wider audience. I don't think, you know, this was something that was planned to help his image because it's just such a complicated thing. And also because he hasn't responded, it makes it a lot harder for anyone to come in and say, to make a judgment call on it. Because if it, you know, this sexual incident is really for him to classify how he feels about it. These other things I think are a little bit more clear that they, while it might be artistic expression, it was in at best poor taste.
And let me just also point out, we actually reached out to Kitty Pryde and asked her to come and join us. And she initially seemed to be considering it, and then she declined and said she didn't want to talk about it anymore. And she seems to indicate on her blog that the whole group just kind of wants to put it, what they're calling that thing, behind them. They don't seem to want to talk about it anymore, but we're talking about it. So, Jessica, I'm asking you, if the fact that he hasn't complained about it, does that mean we still have something to say about it?
Well, I think it's very complicated. I think it's really complicated because we have so many expectations about male sexuality, and a lot of the general media understanding of it and our cultural understanding expectation of it is that men almost have like no control and they have to say yes. And why wouldn't he want this?
Right.
And that brings
right.
up this question right. like, oh, is he gay? Is he this? And it just creates this much uglier discourse about male sexuality and expectation and what we think of performers, that they're supposed to be have these sort of ravenous appetites and, you know, these sort of things. And it becomes just a lot more complicated. And I think by him not addressing it is kind of his best way of trying to avoid having these other conversations.
Malik, what do you think?
I think there's a few things at risk. And the one thing is that, okay, if he's assaulted, I mean, that's a bad thing. But the other thing is that when we don't draw lines for men about their sexuality in terms of having boundaries for them or respect for their bodies, we're not only putting them at risk, but we're potentially putting women at risk as well, because they're applying the same rules that are applied to their bodies to women. And we know that that can't be the case. We have to somehow level the playing field so that there's across the board an understanding about what sexual assault is and what sexuality is. We can't, consent has to be more than, you know, sex being a man's world where women just consent to play in it. It has to be sex is the world that is created when all parties involved are consenting. And if we can somehow level that, then I think that we lower the risk of things like this happening.
Do you mind if I just jump in and say, I feel that Kitty Pryde is kind of the hero here, because I'm thinking of how many times women have been assaulted, and it's their girlfriends who say, women are the ones who come forward to their girlfriends and say, what happened to you is not okay, and you need to put this in its proper light, because there are a number of women who have been treated inappropriately in the sexual realm and didn't stand up for themselves, and other women have come forward to say, well, actually, or actually, it's not okay, and this is how I want you to think about this. So, Danielle, final thought from you?
I was actually proud of her, because there's so much pressure to endorse the status quo. And the status quo is, oh, isn't this awesome that this happened to him, even though he didn't consent to it. That's the status quo. And the fact that she pushed back against that and called it what it was, to me, was a very brave thing and a very noble thing. And, I commend her for it. I was proud of her.
Jessica Hopper, final thought from you?
I think that she did do something important, just as far as bringing to light a bigger discussion that we need to have about male sexuality in hip hop and power and, you know, the dynamic between fans and performers.
I'm wondering what should happen now. That's the other thing I'm wondering. You know, this is one of the interesting things about social media, is that fans now have responsibility for things. They can make things happen by sort of discussing them things and making, as we've seen with these endorsement deals. I'm kind of wondering what should happen now. Malik, you have a final thought?
Well, I agree, and I hope that the tide continues. I hope that fans and people who listen to hip hop and just music in general, or just entertainment in general, we take more accountability, and when we see things that we don't like, we step up and we take action, and we can complain and be vocal about it. It's a shame that it always has to come down to somebody losing their endorsement and taking a financial hit to get the point. But if that's what it takes, then I think that's the direction that we need to go.
Professor Neil, you have a final thought?
You know, it's always about accountability and how do we hold artists and the corporations that they work for accountable in significant kinds of ways. And in the case of Danny Brown, I think it's important also to think about the fact that there will be those who will say that the lyrics, you know, were the reason why this happened, will blame him for his lyrics. And that's just as faulty as a logic that says that a woman deserved to be sexually assaulted because of what she wore. It really does challenge our perceptions about gender and sexual violence in ways that I think will lead to much more healthier conversation.
Well, no, let me push you on that point for a second. You're saying that people are going to say, well, his lyrics are very explicit, so what is he expecting? You're saying that that's wrong. Why is that wrong?
Someone's onstage persona is very different than who he is as the actual person. And what happened in that club in Minneapolis really kind of collapses that space, you know, is where that reality meets fantasy in some regard. But even if his lyrics are sexually explicit, that doesn't mean he should be assaulted because of it.
Professor, you're in a position of kind of helping shape young minds through your work as a professor. Is there something you would want to, what lesson would you want us to draw from this?
Better conversations about male vulnerability in terms of their bodies and sexuality, and particularly in the case of black men. And, I mean, that's one of the things that's kind of lost in this also. Mm-hmm. You know, apparently the young woman was a Caucasian woman and he's a black man. And, of course, there's a whole now 200-year mythology about black male sexuality that I think that also gets tagged into this conversation about what happens on stage.
Malik, what would you want to draw from this? I mean, I'm thinking this might come up in some of your mentoring sessions,
right,
with your young charges. What kind of conversations do you want to have?
I continue to say I want men to know that it's okay to be in complete control of their bodies and to turn down sex. You know, it's not this thing that you have to get every time that it's thrown at you or every time that it's available. You are in control of your body, and if you don't want it, you don't have to take it. And I think a lot of men don't get that, particularly, like Professor Neil said, particularly young black men.
Malik Washington is a youth mentor and deputy director of the William Killebrew Foundation. He joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Mark Anthony Neal is a professor of black popular culture at Duke University. He joined us from the studios at the campus. Music critic Jessica Hopper joined us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. And writer Danielle Belton is editor of Clutch Magazine Online. And she's also the creator of the Black Snob blog. And we reached her at her home office in St. Louis. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Mother's Day is just around the corner. You're probably thinking about what to get mom, but a group of thoughtful women are sharing stories about the best gifts their moms gave them.
These are not extravagant gifts. They are not diamond rings and cars and houses. And I think the message is really about relationships.
We'll tell you about the new book, What My Mother Gave Me, 31 Women on the Gifts That Mattered Most. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, I share some thoughts in my weekly Can I Just Tell You essay. Tomorrow is a tough day for me and my family, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But first, Mother's Day is this Sunday, and I bet a lot of people have been racking their brains trying to think of just the right thing to show love and appreciation for Mom. But recently, a group of distinguished women flipped that script and spent some time thinking about the most important and profound gifts their mothers gave to them. Their essays have been collected in a new book. It's titled What My Mother Gave Me, 31 Women on the Gifts That Mattered Most. We're joined now by two of the contributors. Writer Elizabeth Benedict both wrote an essay and edited the collection. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Cecilia Munoz. She is a Latina activist. She's also a winner of a so-called MacArthur Genius Grant. She contributed another of the 31 essays, and she's here with us also. Welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Elizabeth and Cecilia, I hope at least one of you isn't a crier, because I don't know how we're going to get through this conversation without crying. These are some extremely moving stories. So hopefully somebody's going to stand tough here. Elizabeth, I think you said in the book that it came out of the intense feelings that you had about a scarf that your mother gave you.
Yes, that's true. And actually, I'm wearing the scarf right now. And it's a black scarf with a beautiful embroidery, pastel embroidery. And it was the last gift my mother ever gave me. She bought it at the assisted living facility where she lived. And as soon as I began wearing it, people started commenting on how beautiful it was. And after she died, I wore it all the time in the winter, and I was literally confused by how I could feel this attachment to the scarf and having felt so much distance from my mother. And I was obsessed with it, and I thought about it often, never spoke a word to anyone because I didn't have the words. And one day I said to myself, I wonder if other women have a gift from their mothers that means as much to them and that opens up the relationship the way the scarf does for me.
So with that, do you mind reading a little bit
Sure.
from your essay?
The scarf didn't literally glitter, but it had a glittering effect, or so it felt to me. It caught people's attention often for many months every year for the next 3 years in which my mother declined and then declined precipitously. She was 10 years younger than her sister, but she died a year before. It is painful to remember the years after she gave me the scarf, her journey from the assisted living building to the nursing home, from the floor of okay residence to the floor of the decidedly not okay. I spent a lot of time visiting her and my aunt, who remained on the okay floor until she died. I can't bear to remember the actual names of the floors, the conditions they referred to.
Mm. Beautiful. And the scarf is also beautiful.
Thank you.
If you don't mind my saying that.
Thank you.
Cecilia Munoz, what about you? Why did you want to participate in this collection and write this essay?
Well, I lost my mom about 5 years ago, and it felt like a wonderful opportunity not just to pay tribute to her, but also to reflect on what she gave to me, what she gave to us. In my case, I come from one of those big, sprawling immigrant families, and my mother was very much at the center of it. It was a great opportunity to reflect on sort of what mattered most. So it was a real gift to me to be able to think about it and a tribute to my mom.
Your essay is lovely because I think people who will know your name will know you as kind of a tough advocate for the people, things that you believe in. You know, you've been in the public sphere for a number of years working in a variety of different positions. And of course, as we mentioned, you know, a winner of this very prestigious award. And you wrote about something that I think a lot of people have in their kitchens, but it's not something that's particularly fancy. It is a wok. Will you give us a little bit of your essay?
Sure. My mother spent months looking for the right wok for me. It had to be lightweight because of my carpal tunnel syndrome, and it had to be well-made because my mother was a connoisseur of kitchen tools, not to mention a world-class cook. I don't know if the fact that she was so sick made her search take longer. The wok was the last birthday present she gave me before she died in 2008 after 18 years with cancer. The care she took in finding it is one of the reasons it's so special to me, one of many reasons.
Did you know right away what you wanted to write about? Did you know right away you were going to write about the wok?
I knew right away it would have to be something from my kitchen because we spent so much time together in the kitchen and so much of our relationship and her relationships with all of us had to do with cooking and food and meals, and it didn't take me long to arrive at the wok, and it was the last birthday present she gave me.
Many of the women, as we mentioned, who are collected here, very accomplished in the professional and public realm, but a lot of the things that they're
writing about are very personal things, very much associated with kind of the home. I do want to mention that our beloved colleague Susan Stamberg is also represented in the collection, but I'm going to keep her contribution a little bit secret so that people can discover it. And I'm wondering if people are surprised to find out that a walk means that much to you.
People who know my mother aren't, but maybe people in other aspects of my life might be. And it's a little bit of a meditation on what I think a lot of women, certainly of our generation, go through, which is that my mother was this superb homemaker, and we lived in a quite lovely home that she took great care of decorating and had spectacular meals every day. They felt like events. They weren't just meals. And, you know, for the next generation, that was a pretty tough act to follow. So the essay is also a little bit of a meditation on that she gave me that, but the walk is a little bit of a way in which she also was showing that she accepted that my life was different and that it was okay.
Hmm. Elizabeth, how did you decide what kinds of stories that you wanted to include, what kinds of voices you wanted to include in this collection? I do want to mention that there are a variety of experiences represented here, a wide variety of experiences and relationships that people had with their mothers, some of them quite fraught.
Yes, indeed. I started with the idea that I wanted people to write about an object. And if I had said to all these people, write me an essay about your mother, I think I wouldn't have gotten anything because people would have freaked out. But I think being able to focus on one object and tell the sort of beginning and middle and end of that object and how it radiates and reverberates really allows people to get to the core of the relationship. I wanted, of course, all the people to be very accomplished, all the women to be very accomplished in their fields, and most of them are writers. They are poets, journalists, and fiction writers, but I wanted them all to be accomplished essayists as well. And I wanted a real range of experience, so this really felt like the world that we live in.
There have been times when I've asked people to reflect on an experience, and they just can't do it. It's just too raw. And I wondered if there's anyone whom you approached who just said, I just can't do it.
There was one woman whose mother was sick at the time. I think she was just a little too close to those feelings, which is exactly what you're saying. And there was another woman who had had such a difficult relationship with her mother, and her mother was alive, and I think she felt she couldn't really be candid about it.
Did you see any through line as these essays came in that bound them all together in some way, other than that you had asked?
Sure. I come to this from having had a mother who had a very hard life and was very unhappy, and I had to sort of navigate and negotiate whether I wanted to be unhappy like her or happy and leave her behind, if you will. But I was very pleasantly surprised and happy to see that a lot of women had happy mothers. But even when people had very happy mothers, there was still so much real, serious, interesting, complicated emotion, even in all the happiness. That was the through line. And even though that seems self-evident, of course, you're going to have a lot of feelings about your mother, there was something profound about it to be in that it was repeated in essay after essay.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the book What My Mother Gave Me, 31 Women on the Gifts That Mattered Most. Our guest is editor Elizabeth Benedict. She also contributed one of the essays. Also with us, activist Cecilia Munoz, who contributed another. Cecilia, was there any other essay that, I know this is such a terrible question, but in addition to your own, was there any other essay that really stood out for you?
Well, I was taken by several of them. And I guess when you come to this book, when you think what it's about, it is easy to assume that it's going to be just a sentimental book. And while the sentiment is really very deep, as Elizabeth says, it's also really quite a complex book. I mean, the range of experience that's reflected in this book is really quite vast, and some of the essays are really very sad. Some of them read more like tributes. I feel like mine is a little bit of a tribute to my mom. That's how I intended it. But there's also, you know, elements of it that reflect on things she was sad about in her life or things that she wished she had done that she didn't do.
You talk about that. I want to talk about that for a minute, the fact that your parents were immigrants from Bolivia, had not intended to stay here, had intended to just come finish their education, your dad, and then go right back.
Yeah.
And never did. But also the fact that you thought, you know, your mom was very smart and didn't really get a chance to achieve a lot of formal education and was still really successful.
Yep.
Selling cosmetics.
Yep.
You're vague about who she was selling cosmetics for, but I have a guess. But you pointed out that she was really good at it.
She was really good at it. It's a company that doesn't exist anymore. But my mother was terrific at everything she tried to do and worked very hard at it. It's funny because we didn't see her as a working woman at the time because This was like one of those companies where you do makeup parties, essentially. So she would go off and do that in the evenings, and we would help her pack bags to deliver. But she was terrific at it, but she designed it so that she could also be there to take me to music lessons and take my brothers to debate practice and, you know, be a traditional mom in the same way. She managed to do all of that. And now that I struggle with a more traditional and quite intense job and raising kids, I understand things like why she was washing the kitchen floor at 11 o'clock at night or doing loads of laundry at 6 in the morning. I do the same thing.
Hmm. Elizabeth, you know, it's interesting because your book comes at a time when there's a lot of talk about women and their presence in the workforce and the paid workforce and whether women are making enough progress and, you know, all of this leaning in and what role, you know, kids are supposed to play and all this. And I'm just wondering if, and you also write about in your essay that your own, I don't know if it was painful or not, it felt painful and complex decision yourself about whether you wanted to raise your own children. Mm-hmm. So I'll leave people to read what you have to say about that yourself. But do you think there's any message here, any wisdom here that people can draw from that? Or you think there's some part of the debate that people can get from this book?
One of the most interesting things here is how modest many of these gifts are, how modest most of them are. They are not diamond rings and cars and houses. And I think the message is really about relationships. So one of the gifts, say, is the walk from Cecilia's mother. Another gift is a family photograph. Another gift is a drawing that a mother made that she kept on her door when she was sick. So these are not gifts that have a lot of financial value, but the value of the gifts accrues over time. The value comes from the relationships themselves and how people process the relationships and how people move through their lives with their mothers in life and in memory. So as far as, you know, larger issues, I think that if you want to talk about commerce, you don't have to get extravagant gifts for people. Those may not be the ones that matter most, but the spirit in which you give it and everything that comes before and after are what people remember. So if you're going to be an absent parent but just buy your child fabulous gifts, that may not work out as well in the long run as being present more, however you can do that, and getting more intimate gifts and getting gifts that have sort of emotional value rather than monetary value.
Mm. Cecilia, before we let you go, and don't want to spoil anything, but do you have any special wishes for Mother's Day that we can pass along?
Well, in the spirit of sort of some of the lessons from the book, I think at least for me, at this time I'm looking at being an empty nester. In a few months, I have two daughters, and the second one will be going off quite far to college. So for me, my greatest wish for myself, but for other moms in my life, is time, especially with the people you love.
Cecilia Munoz is a contributor to the book What My Mother Gave Me, 31 Women on the Gifts That Mattered Most. She's a longtime activist on issues around immigration and other issues. She's also a MacArthur Genius Grant Fellowship Award winner. Elizabeth Benedict is editor of What My Mother Gave Me, as well as a contributor. She's also written 5 novels, one of them a National Book Award finalist, and she edited the anthology Mentors, Muses, and Monsters, 30 Writers on the People Who Changed Their Lives. They were both kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, I share some thoughts in my weekly Can I Just Tell You essay. Tomorrow is a tough day for me and my family, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that in a few minutes. But first, Mother's Day is this Sunday, and I bet a lot of people have been racking their brains trying to think of just the right thing to show love and appreciation for mom. But recently, a group of distinguished women flipped that script and spent some time thinking about the most important and profound gifts their mothers gave to them. Their essays have been collected in a new book. It's titled What My Mother Gave Me, 31 Women on the Gifts That Mattered Most. We're joined now by two of the contributors, writer Elizabeth Benedict, both wrote an essay and edited the collection. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Cecilia Munoz. She is a Latina activist. She's also a winner of a so-called MacArthur Genius Grant. She contributed another of the 31 essays, and she's here with us also. Welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Elizabeth and Cecilia, I hope at least one of you isn't a crier, because I don't know how we're going to get through this conversation without crying, because these are some extremely moving stories. So hopefully somebody's going to stand tough here. Elizabeth, I think you said in the book that it came out of the intense feelings that you had about a scarf that your mother gave you.
Yes, that's true. And actually, I'm wearing the scarf right now. And it's a black scarf with a beautiful embroidery, pastel embroidery. And it was the last gift my mother ever gave me. She bought it at the assisted living facility where she lived. And as soon as I began wearing it, people started commenting on how beautiful it was. And after she died, I wore it all the time in the winter, and I was literally confused by how I could feel this attachment to the scarf and having felt so much distance from my mother. And I was obsessed with it, and I thought about it often, never spoke a word to anyone because I didn't have the words. And one day I said to myself, I wonder if other women have a gift from their mothers that means as much to them, and that opens up the relationship the way the scarf does for me.
So with that, do you mind reading a little bit
Sure.
from your essay?
The scarf didn't literally glitter, but it had a glittering effect, or so it felt to me. It caught people's attention often for many months every year, for the next 3 years in which my mother declined, and then declined precipitously. She was 10 years younger than her sister, but she died a year before. It is painful to remember the years after she gave me the scarf, her journey from the assisted living building to the nursing home, from the floor of okay residence to the floor of the decidedly not okay. I spent a lot of time visiting her and my aunt, who remained on the okay floor until she died. I can't bear to remember the actual names of the floors, the conditions they referred to.
Mm. Beautiful. And the scarf is also beautiful.
Thank you.
If you don't mind my saying that.
Thank you.
Cecilia Munoz, what about you? Why did you want to participate in this collection and write this essay?
Well, I lost my mom about 5 years ago, and it felt like a wonderful opportunity not just to pay tribute to her, but also to reflect on what she gave to me, what she gave to us. In my case, I come from one of those big, sprawling immigrant families, and my mother was very much at the center of it. It was a great opportunity to reflect on sort of what mattered most. So it was a real gift to me to be able to think about it and a tribute to my mom.
Your essay is lovely because I think people who will know your name will know you as kind of a tough advocate for the people, things that you believe in. You know, you've been in the public sphere for a number of years, working in a variety of different positions. And of course, as we mentioned, you know, a winner of this very prestigious award. And you wrote about something that I think a lot of people have in their kitchens, but it's not something that's particularly fancy. It is a wok. Will you give us a little bit of your essay?
Sure.
My mother spent months looking for the right wok for me. It had to be lightweight because of my carpal tunnel syndrome, and it had to be well-made because my mother was a connoisseur of kitchen tools, not to mention a world-class cook. I don't know if the fact that she was so sick made her search take longer. The wok was the last birthday present she gave me before she died in 2008 after 18 years with cancer. The care she took in finding it is one of the reasons it's so special to me, one of many reasons.
Did you know right away what you wanted to write about? Did you know right away you were going to write about the wok?
I knew right away it would have to be something from my kitchen because we spent so much time together in the kitchen, and so much of our relationship and her relationships with all of us had to do with cooking and food and meals, and it didn't take me long to arrive at the wok, and it was the last birthday present she gave me.
Many of the women, as we mentioned, who are collected here, very accomplished in the professional and public realm, but a lot of the things that they're writing about are very personal things, very much associated with kind of the home. I do want to mention that our beloved colleague Susan Stamberg is also represented in the collection, but I'm going to keep her contribution a little bit secret so that people can discover it. And I'm wondering if people are surprised to find out that a wok means that much to you.
People who know my mother aren't, but maybe people in other aspects of my life might be. And it's a little bit of a meditation on what I think a lot of women, certainly of our generation, go through, which is that my mother was this superb homemaker, and we lived in a quite lovely home that she took great care of decorating and had spectacular meals every day. They felt like events. They weren't just meals. And, you know, for the next generation, that was a pretty tough act to follow. So the essay is also a little bit of a meditation on that she gave me that, but the wok is a little bit of a way in which she also was showing that she accepted that my life was different and that it was okay.
Mm. Elizabeth, how did you decide what kinds of stories that you wanted to include, what kinds of voices you wanted to include in this collection? I do want to mention that there are a variety of experiences represented here, a wide variety of experiences and relationships that people had with their mothers, some of them quite fraught.
Yes, indeed. I started with the idea that I wanted people to write about an object. And if I had said to all these people, write me an essay about your mother, I think I wouldn't have gotten anything because people would have freaked out. But I think being able to focus on one object and tell the sort of beginning and middle and end of that object and how it radiates and reverberates really allows people to get to the core of the relationship. I wanted, of course, all the people to be very accomplished, all the women to be very accomplished in their fields, and most of them are writers. They are poets, journalists, and fiction writers, but I wanted them all to be accomplished essayists as well. And I wanted a real range of experience, so this really felt like the world that we live in.
There have been times when I've asked people to reflect on an experience, and they just can't do it. It's just too raw. And I wondered if there's anyone whom you approached who just said, I just can't do it.
There was one woman whose mother was sick at the time. I think she was just a little too close to those feelings, which is exactly what you're saying. And there was another woman who had had such a difficult relationship with her mother, and her mother was alive, and I think she felt she couldn't really be candid about it.
Did you see any through line as these essays came in that bound them all together in some way, other than that you had asked?
Sure. I come to this from having had a mother who had a very hard life and was very unhappy, and I had to sort of navigate and negotiate whether I wanted to be unhappy like her or happy and leave her behind, if you will. But I was very pleasantly surprised and happy to see that a lot of women had happy mothers. But even when people had very happy mothers, there was still so much real, serious, interesting, complicated emotion, even in all the happiness. That was the through line. And even though that seems self-evident, of course, you're going to have a lot of feelings about your mother, there was something profound about it to be in that it was repeated in essay after essay.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the book What My Mother Gave Me, 31 Women on the Gifts That Mattered Most. Our guest is editor Elizabeth Benedict. She also contributed one of the essays. Also with us, activist Cecilia Munoz, who contributed another. Cecilia, was there any other essay that, I know this is such a terrible question, but in addition to your own, was there any other essay that really stood out for you?
Well, I was taken by several of them. And I guess when you come to this book, when you think what it's about, it is easy to assume that it's going to be just a sentimental book. And while the sentiment is really very deep, as Elizabeth says, it's also really quite a complex book. I mean, the range of experience that's reflected in this book is really quite vast, and some of the essays are really very sad. Some of them are read more like tributes. I feel like mine is a little bit of a tribute to my mom. That's how I intended it. But there's also, you know, elements of it that reflect on things she was sad about in her life or things that she wished she had done that she didn't do.
Well, you talk about that. I want to talk about that for a minute. The fact that your parents were immigrants from Bolivia, had not intended to stay here, had intended to just come finish their education, your dad, and then go right back.
Yeah.
And never did. But also the fact that you thought, you know, your mom was very smart and didn't really get a chance to achieve a lot of formal education and was still really successful.
Yep.
Selling cosmetics.
Yep.
You're vague about who she was selling cosmetics for, but I have a guess. But you pointed out that she was really good at it.
She was really good at it. It's a company that doesn't exist anymore. But my mother was terrific at everything she tried to do and worked very hard at it. It's funny because we didn't see her as a working woman at the time because this was like one of those companies where you do makeup parties, essentially. So she would go off and do that in the evenings, and we would help her pack bags to deliver. But she was terrific at it, but she designed it so that she could also be there to take me to music lessons and take my brothers to debate practice and, you know, be a traditional mom in the same way she managed to do all of that. And now that I struggle with a more traditional and quite intense job and raising kids, I understand things like why she was washing the kitchen floor at 11 o'clock at night or doing loads of laundry at 6 in the morning. I do the same thing.
Hmm. Elizabeth, you know, it's interesting because your book comes at a time when there's a lot of talk about women and their presence in the workforce and the paid workforce and whether women are making enough progress and, you know, all of this leaning in and what role, you know, kids are supposed to play and all this. And I'm just wondering if, and you also write about in your essay that your own, I don't know if it was painful or not. It felt painful and complex decision yourself about whether you wanted to raise your own children. Mm-hmm. So I'll leave people to read what you have to say about that yourself. But do you think there's any message here, any wisdom here that people can draw from that? Or you think there's some part of the debate that people can get from this book?
One of the most interesting things here is how modest many of these gifts are, how modest most of them are. They are not diamond rings and cars and houses. And I think the message is really about relationships. So one of the gifts, say, is the walk from Cecilia's mother. Another gift is a family photograph. Another gift is a drawing that a mother made that she kept on her door when she was sick. So these are not gifts that have a lot of financial value, but the value of the gifts accrues over time. The value comes from the relationships themselves and how people process the relationships and how people move through their lives with their mothers in life and in memory. So as far as, you know, larger issues, I think that if you want to talk about commerce, you don't have to get extravagant gifts for people. Those may not be the ones that matter most, but the spirit in which you give it and everything that comes before and after are what people remember. So if you're going to be an absent parent, but just buy your child fabulous gifts, that may not work out as well in the long run as being present more, however you can do that, and getting more intimate gifts and getting gifts that have sort of emotional value rather than monetary value.
Cecilia, before we let you go, and don't want to spoil anything, but do you have any special wishes for Mother's Day that we can pass along?
Well, in the spirit of sort of some of the lessons from the book, I think at least for me, at this time I'm looking at being an empty nester. In a few months, I have two daughters, and the second one will be going off quite far to college. So for me, my greatest wish for myself, but for other moms in my life, is time, especially with the people you love.
Cecilia Munoz is a contributor to the book, What My Mother Gave Me, 31 Women on the Gifts That Mattered Most. She's a longtime activist on issues around immigration and other issues. She's also a MacArthur Genius Grant Fellowship Award winner. Elizabeth Benedict is editor of What My Mother Gave Me, as well as a contributor. She's also written 5 novels, one of them a National Book Award finalist, and she edited the anthology Mentors, Muses, and Monsters, 30 Writers on the People Who Changed Their Lives. They were both kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to see photos of some of the gifts mentioned in the book and even share your own story and photo, we'll have a link on our website with more information. Just go to npr.org/tellmemore. Finally today, I'm thinking about how many times I've interviewed someone about some story or another, and that person has said to me, "I always heard about this or that thing on the news, but I never thought this would happen to me." Well, 3 years ago tomorrow, the person saying that was me. 3 years ago tomorrow, my brother took his own life. My handsome, hilarious, infuriating little brother. His name was Norman, but I don't know anybody who called him that. I like to call him Conan, as in Conan the Fireman, because yes, he was a firefighter, and yes, he was totally buff. From high school on, he asked his friends to call him Wade. I have no idea why. And most of his brother firefighters called him Mac. But most of all, and maybe this is a black thing, I don't know, in my family, we mainly just called him Brother. If you mentioned brother to anybody in my family or my close friends, then you'd know we were referring to him. Which is fitting to me because that's who he was, and the word really means something to me. And if you've lost a sibling, then you know what I'm about to say is true. When you lose a sibling, you really feel as if one of the limbs on your favorite tree has been sawed off by a thief. It's been 3 years, and I still find myself looking for that raunchy birthday card from him that I still can't believe is not coming. Every now and again, I still think of something I want to tell him, about something that happened at work or at one of my kids' events. And I have to say to myself, oh, wait, I can't. And then when his birthday rolls around, I find myself racking my brain for a gift for him that I know he'll make fun of. He was really hard to buy for with that bodybuilder neck and all that, but for which he would have written a beautiful thank you note anyway. So you can imagine why I was sad but not shocked to read in the Wall Street Journal last week about a new report by the Centers for Disease Control that the number of deaths by suicide has risen dramatically in the last decade, surpassing even those caused by car crashes and some of the most fatal diseases. The number of suicides rose 31% from just over 29,000 in 1999 to 38,364 in the year 2010. My brother was one of them. Suicide rates for working adults are now double that of the other demographics, according to the Journal article, with people in their 50s showing the highest numbers, men most of all, with the suicides of middle-aged men outnumbering that of women by 4 to 1. And with all of that, the article goes on to say that this is a crisis that's gone largely undetected, under the radar, as it were. Can I just tell you, maybe it's my survivor anger talking here, but I'm not buying it. Throughout the world and throughout time, people, especially men, who feel worthless, find a way to die. When they don't think they can provide for their families in the way that they think they should, when they don't think what they have to contribute to the world is valued, when they don't see a way up or out, they find a way to die. And yes, access to guns is part of it. Lack of access to good mental health care or a willingness to seek it out is part of it. Trauma is part of it. Access to decent employment is part of it. Losing your home is part of it. But is any of this really news to anybody? Is it really that hard to figure out? My question is the same question I find myself asking a lot these days, which is, how many more? How many more funerals do we need to have before we look the problem in the face and fix it? And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.